Hey, what's good? This is Rich.
And I'm Marcus.
And you're listening to Paychecks and Balances, where conversations about work and money go down like wine and the smoothest of whiskeys.
Well done, because there is no PTO for Paychecks and Balances. I come to you just coming off sick leave, and I feel like I'm talking from underwater. Hopefully the nausea doesn't come across on the show, but that's what it sounds like to me inside my own head.
Jameson.
Yeah, I am drinking honey tea as we speak. And you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at the Washed Chronicles, but more officially at Pay Balances, and on Facebook at Paychecks and Balances. Follow our individual accounts at the Marcus Garrett, 1T on Twitter, 2Ts everywhere else, including the Googles. And Rich is available at I Am Rich Jones.
I am. And today's episode is sponsored by LinkedIn Learning. Get a free 30-day trial of their extensive online course library by visiting linkedin.com/paychecks, all lowercase.
And this is right on time, because today's episode is also sponsored by Health IQ, an insurance company that helps health-conscious people get lower rates on life insurance. Go to healthiq.com/paychecks to support the show and see if you qualify.
And special plug to the senior millennials and those with families and or life-changing events slash circumstances. This could be especially for you. And before we get into things, man, happy Black History Month.
And I think we'll be wishing, I'm going to be fair to both. I appreciate that, sir, number one. And then number two, happy Valentine's Day. We're getting all those out of the way. And of course, Singles Awareness Day, hashtag Singles Awareness Day, February 15th. Don't forget y'all as well. Swipe left, swipe right, swipe up.
In related happy news, we're currently featured in the Black History Month category that's on the homepage and Apple Podcasts, which is pretty dope. It's our second time being featured, so we were there last year as well. So thanks to all the listeners that continue to make PNB a thing. We're going to keep striving to lift as we climb and all that other good stuff. So who's up for discussion today, man?
I would quickly add, for those who went to the Black History feature last year, that has been expanded this year. So don't assume that it's just us. And I think it was like five or six last year. There's a pretty extensive representation there. So go and show love to the other folks in the Black History feature this month. A lot of those that we've both had on the show and that we circulated and interacted with on the interwebs.
The Twitters.
But speaking of which, today we are chatting with Jeannie Ahn, whom we met at the CBS Now, and we'll get that in the show notes for those of you who missed it.
You met her.
We cover a number of topics, but mostly career and salary negotiation. A lot of great tips here, and we hope you enjoy.
Indeed.
Some of you may remember Jeannie for the CBSN Your Money Matters panel, available at paychecksandbalances.com/CBSNow. But for those of you who are new here, welcome aboard. Jeannie is a reporter and senior producer who specializes in making personal finance and career guidance fun by helping viewers make smarter money moves at Yahoo Finance and at Oath. Thank you for joining us, Jeannie. Is there anything else from your background that you'd like to share with the people?
Hey guys, thanks for having me. Background, I've changed my careers a bunch of times. So I'm super passionate about people who are confused and trying to find their purpose and find to, you know, have a career that's meaningful to them.
So you mentioned you changed your career a lot. So what was the path?
So I started in city government. Basically, what happened was I always thought I was going to be a musician. And when that I realized that compared to other people that were far more serious at it than I was, that maybe it wasn't the only path for me. So I majored in sociology because I enjoyed the subject matter, but at the same time, I just really loved my teachers. And what I did was I had a music internship at Jive Records. I was like, okay, if I can't be a musician, I want to work with artists. But then that was a time where everybody was downloading music for free. And, you know, basically there were a lot of layoffs.
Those were the days.
Yeah. That kind of dates me, I'm sure. But I think that what happened was I was so confused. A lot of people that I went to school with seemed so clear on what they wanted to do. And that also made me feel so discouraged. So I ended up taking the first job that was offered to me. And I worked at the Taxi and Limousine Commission in New York City.
So were you fielding all the angry calls or?
You know, I wanted to work for the mayor. I wanted to work for the mayor's office. And along the way, I had to pick up a bunch of recommendations and references. And one person that I knew said that, you know, you can go there. It's a friend of a friend. They can give you a reference. And in that conversation for the reference, he ended up offering me a job. And he said that I would be doing focus groups with taxi drivers and kind of like improving the quality of life for drivers and for New York City passengers. So I was like, all right, well, he is offering me a job on the spot. I don't know if I'm going to get this other job that I'm going for. So I took it. And I really hated it. Like, I kind of took a role that had no job description, and I just did miscellaneous projects. And, you know, I did put on like an award ceremony for taxi drivers, and I talked to taxi drivers and did all of this, you know, kind of random stuff. And I wasn't passionate about it. And so I was told that you're not supposed to leave a job before a year. So I stuck it out for exactly 1 year. And then I like was like, peace, I am out of here. And I was like, what is the opposite of this? Because I didn't know still at that point what I wanted to do. So I was like, okay, if I'm going to work for the city government and make no money, I might as well make money while I figure out what I want to do. So I started working at a hedge fund, doing marketing work as a marketing assistant. And, you know, that was a brutal world. It was a real wake up call, you know. Working at a place like Yahoo Finance and is a lot different. I mean, we're all about money too, but when you're working with hedge fund managers, and that was not an environment that I was happy in, because everyone was so, their mood, their behavior, you know, I felt like they're investing money for like millionaires. And it wasn't an environment that I was passionate about again or comfortable in. And I didn't want to surround myself with like the ups and downs of the market and how crazy that can make someone act, you know?
Right.
And I also was not treated very well in that particular job. So I decided, all right, I have no idea what I want to do. I'm jumping around and I just need to focus. So then I just traveled. I took on these temp jobs that I could earn just enough money to take me and my brother to Europe on a backpacking trip. And I was like, that backpacking trip is going to be the time when I just think about what I want to do. I really, really like dig in and figure out, like, ask myself the questions about purpose. And I had so much fun on that trip. I did not think about my career at all. And I got back and, you know, I was watching a lot of TV like I always do. I think I was unemployed for 3 months and I moved in with my parents. It was the only time I moved back in with my parents after I graduated. It was for a period of 3 months. It drove me absolutely insane living with them.
That was going to be my question. I was going to ask you, how did you feel about having to move back in? Like, did you feel like you were a failure, or were you just like, you know what? I got to do this. This is what's going to get me closer to whatever my goal is, even though I don't know what that is right now.
You know, I had no choice. I used basically everything that I had saved for this trip with my brother, and I thought it was worth every penny. And I was like, you know what, I'll figure it out. And I did all of my job applications and job searches at night when my parents were sleeping. So when they woke up in the morning, I was sleeping in late. I was watching a lot of TV. And I remember my parents were like, what are you doing with your life? And you know, where are you applying to? And I'd be like, I think I want to work for Oprah. I think I want to move. I think I want to work in media. And they were like, what? Like, what? This girl is nuts. They wouldn't even drive me to the post office to mail my letters and my applications because they literally did not believe in what I wanted to do, which at that point I figured, you know, I think it's media. I think it's in the world of media. And living with them was not great for me. And so I moved out as soon as I could. And that was great. But I got a job working at Time Inc. in consumer research. So it was kind of back to consumers, talking to people, figuring out what was worth it for them, what was not worth it, but working for magazine titles. And there, I really discovered what I wanted to do because they offered these classes. They had a tuition reimbursement program that was set for a certain limit every year. And you could take anything at the time. You could take cooking, you could take writing, whatever. And I told myself, listen, I just broke up with this guy. I want to focus on myself. And they have this like free money on the table. I'm going to put it towards something. And all the classes that I seem to want to take, are under this journalism umbrella. So I'm going to go for my journalism certificate at NYU and kind of see where that takes me. So, and I did that for about a year.
Let me ask a couple questions here. That journey, how long was that period of evolution from the first backpacking trip to the realization of your purpose?
I mean, I wouldn't say it's like the realization of my purpose. I would say it was like kind of going towards what I liked and kind of figuring out what I didn't like, which I think was so valuable. And yeah, I spent a year at my first job that I hated, 6 months at the next job I hated. I would say like 2 to 3 years.
I think that's good for people to hear, because I was going to ask you for your lessons learned or advice. I've somehow never been officially laid off. I got a complicated story about the 2 times I came close, but I always find another job like right when I'm on the cusp. Two of those were in college. But I tell people to approach the next job like it's 40 hours. So most people, they're like, oh, I'm going to look for what I like. I'm going to only apply, like you said, at night. And I'm not saying that you didn't, but I tell people, if you are laid off, approach it like you set an alarm, wake up at 8, and you apply from jobs from 8 to 5. Because that's what, number one, that's going to mentally prepare you for when you do get that 9 to 5 job. And number two, I believe it like sets you on a schedule of which you're putting in that 40 hours of work. And then when you get that job, something else you mentioned that I think a lot of people leave on the table, and Rich and I have talked about this, is those tuition reimbursement programs, but just benefits mm-hmm. that your job offer you. I just feel people, they either don't know they exist or they don't take advantage of them. Is there any other lessons you feel that you learned in moving through those multiple jobs?
I would say there was always somebody that I had talked to. There was always a mentor where I worked. And it wasn't even something that I was looking for, but because I was so hungry to find what would make me happy, I ended up talking to people a lot about how they ended up where they were and why they were there and what they liked about what they did and what they didn't. And, you know, that's, people will share that with you. People like talking about themselves and what they went through. And especially if you're an introvert or if you hate your job and you're kind of in this like mode of misery at work, you don't want to talk to anyone, and you don't, the last thing you want to do is have lunch with somebody, you know, especially where you work. You just want to leave. You want to take a walk. You want to come back, you know. But I think that it was really important because those are the people that gave me the confidence to move on, you know, even if they liked it where they were or whether or not they did, they were on my side. You know, I think they could relate to somebody on the journey. And so for me, even today, I would say for the most part, I'm an extrovert. Mm-hmm. I feed off of people's energy. But on Mondays, I don't know who's an extrovert on Mondays. Mondays are hard, you know?
Yeah, that's fair. Did you hear any consistent themes from those mentors or your network? Or did they kind of, and I'll give an example. So we have a lot of people on the show, as you said, that tend to be in the millennial range. We are senior millennials, we found out from a listener. But that being said, pretty much anyone that went to college, I didn't realize how many had a story of, yeah, I got this t-shirt and then I got $10,000 in debt, because everyone had that table that they could go to and get that free swag and then sign up for credit cards. I feel like that's like a marker of this probably exennial generation, which I'm pretty sure an older millennial made up to make themselves feel better. With that being said, where they have this story that, you know, millions, if not hundreds of thousands of people can relate to. Did you see any of those consistent themes from these mentors? Like, I wish I had, and then X was always the same.
A lot of people that were older than me that I looked up to told me, you're really hard on yourself. And I didn't think I was hard on myself. I was like, everybody that I graduated with seemed to have jobs lined up and, you know, knew what they wanted to do and study from the moment they were freshmen in college. And I am so behind. Like, how could you say that I'm hard on myself, you know? Mm-hmm. But I realized that the people now that I look back and had it figured out are all doing completely different things. The people that are not doing completely different things are not so happy, you know? Mm-hmm. Somebody like who chose what they wanted to do and stuck to it, it's very rare that you say, I'm going to study to be a doctor, end up being a doctor, or say, I'm going to be a lawyer and actually end up there. I think that that's a very rare gift, you know? And if you have that and you know it, then amazing, great for you. But I would say probably 90% of the people out there, that's not the journey. 90% of the people out there is they jump around, they figure it out. You don't hear about that all the time, but everyone has it 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 times in their life when they're standing in front of some sort of career section at a bookstore. And they're like, what quiz do I need to take to tell me what my next move is, you know? Or, you know, on a path of discovery every few years. I think that's also something that you shouldn't knock. Like, that is so important that you are listening to yourself and that you're changing and growing, that you want to learn more, that the one thing that you chose is not the be all and the end all, because that would be boring.
It would. It would. And so for the mentors, it sounds like you just had conversations with people. So did those people know they were your mentors, or were those more informal conversations?
I guess they were informal mentors. Just to continue on a little bit, once I got my journalism certification after a year, I knew by that last class that I was going to be a journalist. I knew it. And I never felt like that about anything. I never felt like that about being a musician, working in the music industry, working anywhere. And it makes sense because my father's a minister and he's a storyteller. And I really wanted to tell real people's stories. And that's something that I always knew and I felt very strongly about. But because I had a full-time job, it was very hard to get work as a journalist in any way, because my full-time job was very, very demanding. Also, when you are applying to jobs and you have no experience, they're not going to hire you. And also, if you say, I'll do it for free, they're like, oh, well, you're not in an internship program. You can't do it for free because we can't even give you credit. Like, we can't just like have you here. And so it was very, very challenging. I applied to jobs like $10 an hour at New York One. You know, and I said, okay, well, if I get that job, I'm going to take it. I'm going to work at Starbucks to get health insurance. I had this whole like plan, but yeah, even they wouldn't hire me at the time. And so it was a really dark period because I gave myself 1 year of a deadline. I said, if you don't get a job as a journalist in 1 year, you're going to have to go to journalism school. And that's where you will pay for your connections. You'll study more and you'll network there. And you'll get a job there, or you'll get a job that way. But day in and day out, you know, you're like working this full-time job that you don't love. And any downtime you have, any interview you get, I am running downstairs to a random bathroom, changing into a suit, going to that interview, coming back, getting out of my suit, trying to finish that job by that deadline. It was like an insane time. And then you're like, and I wasn't even getting the job offers. So I was so depressed. And I think that what I had to do after a certain while was I had to wake up in the morning and I just had to pray and let it go. Like, God, this is what I want. But if you don't want me to have it, then I won't have it. And so I just give it to you. I will let go of this energy so that I can have a decent day, you know? And I did that for every single day. I woke up and I did that. And I'm a believer. And so I really believe that he had the best thing in store for me. And it was worth the wait. It was 9 months of job searching, but it was also 9 months more than job searching. It was 9 months of heavy networking. And that means I was a part of every organization that I could like pay $100 a year annual membership to get into. I attended breakfasts at 6 a.m. I asked people if I could take them to coffee, drinks, dinner, lunch, breakfast, anything. And I was just talking to a lot of people and saying, you know, who do you know that I can talk to? Can you give me five names? And I would take those five names down and then talk to those five people. And those five people won't always get back to you. So you're left with two, but those two people will talk to you and help you and they'll give you five other names. And so I did that for 9 months and it was a hustle, but it was so worth it. I learned so much. And I wish that I did more of that now, because once you are in a place at a job that you love, you kind of just stop, you know? And I think that to a certain extent, you have to give yourself a goal and a deadline and say, once a month or once a week, I'm going to have lunch with a different person and, you know, get outside of my comfort zone, because networking has always led me to my next job after that.
It sounds like your own mid-level marketing. I mean, I don't want to brag. I used to sell knives door to door unsuccessfully. But that reminded me of when I thought I was going to take the industry over its ear. One thing you mentioned here, and it actually related to another listener question. They were asking about coding, but I know certifications. I actually took a program as well, and it helped me out a lot, saved me $50,000. Did you stumble upon that? Are you a proponent of certification versus full 4-year degrees, or why did you choose that pathway?
I chose certification because it was the amount that I felt comfortable in paying. I wasn't going to go into debt if I didn't have to. And I was going to explore not going into debt as much as I possibly could. And so I thought that getting a certification, it might not be enough. And if it's not enough, I will take it to the next level. But in that course, I really liked the professors there. They gave you a decent amount of homework. And the actual class itself, you can network in that class. These are all working professionals, you know, who are trying to learn and grow and continue their education. And so I really, after my certification class course, there was 5 courses that took me 1 year to complete. After that, I took more classes at another school because I had to kind of like round out the things that I thought were missing in that class were at NYU. So I went to NYU for my journalism certification. And then after that, I went to the new school to take more classes. And I also was just doing that because I knew I had tuition reimbursement and I also wanted to keep doing it as much as I could. Yeah, I really advise trying not to go into debt because I think that if you can learn on the job, it's better than going to school to learn about a field.
Along this journey, at what point do you think you start to see the realization of salary negotiation? Is that something you were able to do? Because I think something that people struggle with is, can I really ask for a salary negotiation at my first job or honestly, even my second job? When you were talking about those, you know, those $10 an hour opportunities, most people might not feel comfortable. Or did you have a different experience?
Okay, so I was really bad at salary negotiation in the first couple jobs that I had. My first job was in, you know, city government, so they didn't pay much anyway. At the hedge fund, I got almost double what I made at the last job. So going from the hedge fund job to a bunch of these temp jobs to working at the media company, I went down about 20,000. And I remember thinking, I'm going to do it. I'm going to start at the bottom. It's going to be okay. You know, basically what I did was like, I lived with roommates. I knew I couldn't live at home. So I did whatever I could to live independently, but not have my rent exceed like 40% of my income, you know, and luckily with roommate situations, I was able to always keep it down pretty low, like 30% of my income. And I would live in like random parts of Brooklyn where nobody would want to even visit you. But hey, like if you're focused on career, like you're focused, you know, you're, if you have a boyfriend, your boyfriend will visit you, you know?
Yeah. Let me ask this. How did you derive 40%, or is that a number you made up or you had read it somewhere? Like why 40%?
Because I had other expenses. Like I knew that I wanted to go out and eat. I knew that I wanted to go buy clothes. You know, there were just basic life expenses. And I don't think I could never get myself to pay more than a certain amount in rent, you know? And so it's just kind of like looking back on it, I'm able to save, I would say 25 to 40% is what I spent on my rent. But at the time, I didn't really think of it that way percentage wise. I just thought, this is what I'm comfortable with. And I'm not comfortable with much, you know? So that's pretty much how I broke it down. At salary negotiation, I would say every single time I started a different career, I always started right back at the bottom. So, you know, I don't think you can negotiate very well when you're first starting out and you're going from literally opposite job to the opposite job, different opposite industries, you know, it's really hard to compare. I think that I could have done a better job saying things like, these are the things that kind of cross over in skill. And I think I did that to the best that I could. But to work in media, yeah, I took another $20,000 cut. And so I had worked my way up there, you know, as the first media company that I was working at for magazines. And then when I got a job at ABC News, it was a full-time staff job. And I wasn't even expecting that, you know, because I had such a hard journey. I mean, it was short-lived now that I think back about it, but 9 months of networking and getting rejected, you know, does a toll on your confidence. So I think looking back on that, when they offered me a full-time job with benefits and it was like the base salary, like a very, very low salary. I just said, yes. I was jumping up and down. I think I was at Home Depot at the time and they called me. I was literally jumping up and down in an aisle of Home Depot by myself, and I took it. And so what actually happened was, in news, you know, with breaking news coverage, you're working around the clock, and all the overtime that I made up for the salary cut that I took. But yeah, after that job, after my first job as an actual journalist, that's when I became a lot better at salary negotiation.
Mm. So looking back, you mentioned that when you're changing jobs or you're resetting, it's kind of hard to be able to negotiate. But now that you've got a little bit more knowledge under your belt, and I know we'll talk a little bit more about that, is there anything that you would say to someone who is thinking about making that transition and maybe they need to go back and start at more of an entry-level role because they are changing fields? Are there additional points or additional advice you would give to those people now so that they don't feel so powerless because they know that they're taking a step back?
I think that even if you take a step back in your career with your salary, if you are starting all over and it's on a journey and a different path that you are optimistic about, and you know that that is the path for you, that the money will follow. You will make more than you could have made at your last job, because your last job that you didn't like, because you can only get so far in a job that you don't like or in an industry that you don't care for. But if you move on and you take a few steps backwards, you can catapult yourself, because that level of drive and passion that you have at something new, at something different that you've been pursuing, will take you so much further. And that's happened to me 2 or 3 times over. So I know for a fact that staying in a place where you are not happy is, or where you're not, staying in a place where you're not happy, or you're not growing, or you're just not fulfilled in any way, or you're bored. Those are all really bad signs.
And appreciate you saying that, because we had an episode, and we'll plug in the show notes. It was episode 70, talking about making money moves. But the article that got most people's attention was from Forbes. The article is 2014, but it seems to have revved its head up again, because it says the average current employee will receive a 2-5% raise, but new hires can expect 10-20%. And people couldn't get over the job hopping, which I thought was almost crazy, because people are so ingrained to be loyal, more loyal to the company than what's in their own best interest. And so people were writing about, well, but what about people who see my application? What would they think about I've switched these jobs? I'm like, well, if you want to cost yourself 15%, this seems like a strange argument that you're having with me. If you want to cost yourself more money, what are your thoughts, or have you had any bad experience where someone's looked at your resume and like, well, she's had, I wasn't counting here, but she's had five jobs in these past few years. Has that ever come back to haunt you?
That has never, ever once come back to haunt me. I think that my resume was a question mark in a lot of people's minds, because they were like, does this girl know what the hell she wants to do with her life? You know, it's like literally going from a money-making place to like city government to hedge fund to media to, you know, what is she doing? And what I would recommend is look up the person who is going to be interviewing you. That first step, maybe it's the HR person, maybe it's not. Maybe you're going directly to the hiring manager, but look at that person's history. Look them up on LinkedIn. Do any amount of digging that you can and find a common ground with that person. So when you get in a face-to-face interview, or you get an interview over the phone, which phone interviews you should also take very seriously, because if you're unprepared, people can tell. I think that you need to establish that kind of harmonizing. Maybe that person did a random kind of job that like you in an industry. Maybe that person studied something similar to you. My thesis in college was about the appropriation of hip hop into Asian culture, Asian American culture. And I think that also people were like, what is that? You know, what does that even mean? And so you kind of, even if your resume seems all over the place, there is always a way that you can ground it into a way that is about pursuing something different, or you can ground it in commonality with the other person so that that particular person understands where you're coming from.
If one of the best ways to boost your earnings is to get a new job, then one of the best ways to get a new job is to pick up new skills. LinkedIn Learning makes it easy with a robust online course catalog that you can access from anywhere. The courses are easy to navigate, and you can watch, listen, or read along from the transcripts and use project files and quizzes to ensure you're picking up the right things. And if you want to take a nap because you're washed, then take a nap. you'll be able to pick up right where you left off when you wake up. For a free 30-day trial of LinkedIn Learning, visit linkedin.com/paychecks. Again, that's linkedin.com/paychecks, all lowercase, and thanks to LinkedIn for sponsoring the podcast. This episode is also sponsored by HealthIQ, an insurance company that uses science and data to secure lower rates on life insurance for health-conscious people. Now, let's be real. Life comes at you fast. If you recently got married, had a child, experienced a health scare, or had a family member experience one, you know how quickly things can change. Don't get caught slipping into the afterlife. I guarantee your loved ones won't love that. You can qualify for up to 33% savings by taking a HealthIQ quiz and scoring elite and or membership to a qualifying association or gym for more than 1 year. You got to call for more details about that, though. To see if you qualify for the most exclusive rates, get your free quote today at healthiq.com/paychecks. Again, that's healthiq.com/paychecks. And now back to the show. And for the phone interview in particular, so I'm this person who, when I know that I have a phone interview coming up, I've got two screens up, I've got something in front of me. Did you have a routine for phone interviews? Because you mentioned that they are so important. So were there special things that you did to prepare for those in particular, since you couldn't see the person's face on the other end?
Yes. First of all, you are so smart to do that. And anybody, if you have a phone interview, it's a huge advantage because you can literally have words in front of you. You can have paper in front of you, your laptop in front of you, whatever it is. And especially when you're negotiating your salary, because a lot of times they'll come back to you with a number. You know, and you have to be ready at that moment to not sound flustered or unprepared. And so I do this with the people close to me. If I know that they're going through some sort of salary negotiation, is we practice what the phone interview will be. You know, we literally I say like ring, ring, and they'll say hello. We'll do everything, you know, and sometimes I'll be like the tough recruiter who literally says no to every request you say. And sometimes I'll come back to you with a question, and you have to be prepared for these answers. And no one's prepared for these questions and answers. These are really uncomfortable conversations. When it comes to fighting for more money, you don't want to come off as greedy or arrogant or that you don't want the job, because oftentimes you do if you're fighting for it and the salary at the time. So what I do is I have a list. And I say, if that person comes to me with this number, I will say this number. If that person says this number, I will say this number. And I have it all on an Excel spreadsheet so I can at least counter with something. And I also have a list on the side of the non-financial benefits that they can throw in, like vacation time, tuition reimbursement. And I say things like, okay, if you can't make it on this number, I just want you to know that I would like to know what you would like me. I would like to know what you would like me to accomplish within 3 to 6 months. If I accomplish, and then they tell you what those things are. And I say, if I accomplish those things, can we revisit this salary conversation in 6 months? And then if they're like, oh, wow, you know, first of all, if you take that, you start your job and you hit the ground running, you know what their objectives for you are. You hit all those marks out of the park in 6 months and you set a day to meet, a day and a time to meet at that 6 month mark and say, this is what we talked about during my onboarding process. And I just following up on that, you know, and then that's another way to get a raise before your year is up.
Mm.
So, you know, my husband, he doesn't like to do these, you know, mock interviews with me, like in person. And my brother, like, you'd be surprised, guys and girls, nobody likes to do it, but you can't go in unprepared because you are literally leaving money on the table.
Mm. And you mentioned that you prepare even for the negotiation piece. So is that something that you prepare for the first call? Because sometimes when you talk to a recruiter first, and for those who are new to the show, I'm a recruiter by day. So this is something that is near and dear to my heart and my 9-to-5. In fact, I probably spend like 42 hours per week on this. But is that something that you prepare for even for the first call? So let's say it's a recruiter reaching out to you on LinkedIn. Are you already having talking points for salary at that point in case they give you the, so what are you expecting? What are you thinking? You know, what type of ballpark would you like to be in? Because I think that trips people up because they're not prepared to have that conversation yet because they don't know anything else about the role. But oftentimes that is one of the first questions that a recruiter will ask about.
Right. I think, yes, I think you should have that conversation ready to go at all times. And if you've worked enough. And let's say you're working in your industry now. You don't want to make less than you're making now. You want to give yourself some sort of bump. So to a certain extent, you have to know what you're comfortable in saying and just practice saying it out loud. Just practice it, like just say it 10 times. By the time you say it your 10th time, it won't feel so weird, you know? And if that's, you know, in writing, I would say probably that is better to say over the phone, because you can always, with your voice, you know, kind of massage the things that you say. Things can, you know, seem a little abrupt when you're saying these kinds of things over email. So I would say if you can have these kinds of conversations over the phone, try to do that. I'd rather get on the phone with you. And also when you're on the phone with a recruiter, that recruiter is oftentimes the person that you have to get through to talk to the next person, you know, that's actually hiring. I mean, am I right?
Yeah. So typically there's certain information that we're looking for. Is this person available? What are their motivations in terms of compensation? Where are they looking to be? So it's super common for those things to naturally come up in conversation. And oftentimes we don't even get into the in-depth stuff about tell me about a time when. That's more so for when you actually speak to a hiring manager or you actually start the interview process with somebody who's not part of the HR department. And so I also want to jump back quickly because you mentioned something that I think a lot of people don't do, and that's requesting that somebody hop on the phone for a call. And I know that I've reached out to people on LinkedIn or I've emailed someone and the first question that they ask is, how much does this position pay? And I've had to learn over the years, because I've been in this position on the other side where it's like, you know what, you don't want to waste someone's time. And I also don't want to have someone come in and interview for a position, have them spend 5 hours with us, have 5 hours of business time dedicated for this person, only to find out that the numbers aren't going to work. But I do think it's better to have that conversation over the phone, because when I see emails like that, I'm like, this guy, girl, man, woman. And it does make me feel some type of way. And I think a good portion of that is because I can't hear their tone, or there's no additional context around that where it's like, hey, I just got a promotion. I just want to make sure that this role is within the ballpark. So I'm glad you made that point. Now, are there things with salary negotiation that you see people typically leave out or not think about?
Yeah, but can I just go back to your point about the whole phone call? Because, you know, I'm not good at making jokes, but at least you can get that person on the phone. And when you have a conversation and you find that common ground, you get off the phone and maybe you end the phone call with some sort of joke or a lighthearted note, that person will remember you because that person has heard your voice. That person knows that maybe down the line there's a higher paying job, a few levels above the one that they were initially calling you for, but that you're not going to be dumped in the trash pile. That they're going to note your resume and hopefully put it in a folder that says this is a promising person, or print it out and say, you know, this is a promising person. Or even better, have a conversation with the hiring manager and say, hey, listen, I called this person for you. A little bit higher than what you guys want to pay, but this person's bringing all of this extra stuff on, all these added value pieces, and you guys want to at least meet with her, you know? And then, I mean, that's the best case scenario. So, and you wouldn't do that, you wouldn't get that ever if you just ended it in an email.
You know, I cannot disagree with that at all, because there are people that maybe they weren't even the strongest candidate, but I just really liked how they interacted. And I thought that they would be a good fit for that particular team in terms of personality or whatever else. And I went to bat for those people and said, you know what, this person doesn't have everything in their resume, but they have a lot of these other intangibles that you're probably not going to find elsewhere. And thinking about the last two or three people that we had into this role, or what you said you wanted in the person who comes into this role, I think the person has that. And I've even been in situations myself where I didn't think I had everything for the role, but I think how I conducted myself during the interview and how I was myself during the interview played as much of a factor as the actual experience that I had. And so it sounds like you're saying pretty much the same thing there.
It's social skills. You know, you want to hire someone with social skills anyway. You want to hire somebody that people would enjoy working with, that doesn't sound like a complainer, that sounds like a go-getter. And these are all things that you can relay in your tone of voice or just in a conversation that you have that's more lighthearted versus all in an email. So, I mean, you know this.
Indeed.
Clearly.
So I know I've seen this personally, so I'll give a couple of life hacks here so I won't put you on the spot. But one thing that I've definitely seen people leave off, and I'm not sure if this applies to your job searches, is cost of living adjustment. So one of my favorites, because it's the most comprehensive, is Bankrate. CNN Money has one. It's literally just a slide bar. Do you have any favorite apps for adjusting for cost of living or seeing what the salaries are out there? We know there's Payscale, Glassdoor, Salary. I think it's literally salary.com as well. All these things. I'll get the show notes. Okay, great. Any of those ring a bell? Is there one that you have as a go-to resource?
You know, I would say I don't have one in particular. I'd say check all of those places. I feel like some of the websites that you mentioned, like Glassdoor, particularly in my industry, I felt like they kind of lowball it. And I'm like, oh my God, that's insane that they would say that this is what they make, because I know that for a fact that they make more than that. But what's best is if when you are networking and you're having these conversations, at a certain point, you get to a point, hopefully in your life, you have actual mentors that you can call during these difficult salary negotiations or when you need to give a range of what you want to make, and literally pick up the phone, call that person and say, does this sound reasonable? You know, is this a good range, or is this actually, am I crazy to even consider it? And I definitely have those people in my life that I can call and ask those questions to. And, you know, you don't start with those conversations. You start with coffee and lunch, and you find out, just ask them generally about their career and their path and their journey, what's next for them. But if you look up to that person and that person's advice, over other types of career things, when it comes to salary and you're having a moment where you're at a crossroads, it's okay. And it's great if you can call and have, you know, very frank conversations. I remember doing that when I was going from show to show. I knew that other people on my team were making more doing the same thing, but that they were really giving me a hard time because I came in at a certain rate and they thought that they could continue paying me that. I called my mentor and I said, this is what they're trying to do. This is what I know she makes and this, whatever. What can I say? Do you have any tips? And, you know, you'll come away with two or three different things to say. And then when somebody else kind of tells you that and kind of gives you that extra nudge and encouragement, I found that it gives me the strength to actually say it back to somebody else. Because again, these conversations are so uncomfortable, but I think anybody who has a salary negotiation conversation with you will walk away being more impressed with you 100% versus if you didn't ask for it more at all. It's not that you're going to come across as ungrateful or somebody that's entitled, but you're smart. If you ask for more, that is just basic smarts in my mind. If you don't ask for more, then I guess I'm lucky, but I would rather go for somebody who's smart and who's asking for more, because that person will come on the job and also be just a bit of a hustler, you know, and you want that. Somebody who's just like willing to be creative to get to the solution. And when it comes to your salary, I think women have a harder time doing it, but it's really too bad that that's the case.
Yeah, and that could be a whole conversation in itself. That's a big topic out here in Silicon Valley where I'm based. I mean, it's a big topic in the country in general, and I know that there are states now that are moving toward not even allowing companies to ask somebody about their previous salary history. So, for example, where I'm at in the Bay Area, we can't even ask candidates, what did you make in your previous role? What are you making currently? Because that becomes such an anchor in terms of what that company is going to try to offer them going forward, unless it's one of the companies that really believes in paying people the market rate, which you'll be surprised is not as many companies as one would think. There are some where if you say a number, they want to try to get you at the lowest price possible as if you're a commodity versus the companies that are more so about doing the right thing. And even that doing the right thing, it's, they're probably doing that to avoid lawsuits, which is also another conversation.
Right.
But is there any type of formula that you typically give people? And I know it's going to vary widely depending on the role, but some people are like, do I ask for 10% more? Do I ask for 15% more? Do I ask for 10K over what my true accept number would be? Do you have any kind of general guidance or rule of thumb that you tell people to work with if they're struggling with not having kind of a concrete formula to work off of?
Well, again, if you are making the low end of what you should be making, then yeah, ask for 20, 30% more for the next place, because you're not going to get 20 to 30% more necessarily. You're probably going to get 15. You have to know that it's a negotiation. So it's going to, you're going to ask for something, they're going to give you less than that. So you always have to ask for higher than what you actually want. And again, that feels like anyway, that takes a little bit of balls because you're like, oh my God, that is a crazy amount. They're going to take the job off the table, but they won't if you approach it right. And most likely, if they're already at the point of offering you the job, I mean, they're not going to take that job off the table at that point. I would say 20% is a good average, you know, saying that you're in the middle range of your industry or what you should be making. And as you move up, you're probably taking a lot more responsibility. You're hopefully moving up. Your position is more demanding. So 20%, 20 to 30%, I think that would be a really solid amount because you're probably going to get more like 15, 20%, you know?
And I love the point you made about offers not coming off the table. In my career, I have never seen an offer pulled from a candidate because candidate asked for too much money. If nothing else, it's, yo, we can't do that. Take it or leave it. This is what it is. Or, you know, maybe we negotiate some other type of perk or benefit, but I've never seen a job offer pulled from someone asking for too much money. What I have seen happen is someone says, if you can get me X, I'll accept this position today. I go back and get them X, or the recruiter goes back and gets them X, and the person goes, well, actually, and they come back and make another ask, and then it's like, all right, I'll see. And well, actually, when a person does that, it speaks toward their inability to keep their word, and I have seen offers pulled in that scenario. So that's probably like the one spot where I've seen somebody asking for more actually work against them, but that's also because the way that they went about it also spoke to their character.
And their social skills, like that's just poor social skills, you know, but also exactly as a recruiter, what you said needs to be repeated 5 million times, which is you've never seen an offer get pulled off the table because they asked for more. And, you know, I do this exercise. I did this with the interns at Yahoo. I made them negotiate with me their salary and they've never done it before, you know, but I gave them some pointers before we started the fake phone call. Where literally I'm just across the room with my hand to my ear being like, ring, ring, you know, but these kids like pick up the phone. They're in college. They've never done this before. And some kids totally freeze up. And I'm like looking at them from across the room and I'm saying like, hello, hello, are you there? And it just, they're speechless because if you come back to them a certain way, they don't know how to counter that. And so it takes a lot of practice. Asking for more takes, I would say, before you get on a conversation to do a salary negotiation, you should have practiced at least 3 hours with two different people in your life. You know, consider that money well spent. You practice it, you get your tone. The first 30 minutes, you're going to suck. You're going to be like mad at the other person for being tough on you during the practice session. You know, there's going to be a lot of like pride and ego and some, maybe some fighting.
Ignoring their text messages.
Yeah. So you just have to cut. No, I mean, literally, like, get somebody you trust and say, okay, can you play the part of a tough recruiter? Or can you play the part of, like, you know, whatever? And you have to also get the right person to do this phone call with you, this practice phone call with you, because some people won't be good at it. You know?
True. Yeah.
Some people will just really, really be bad at it. But get somebody on the phone who you know is kind of a ball buster and kind of thrives on this. And get on the phone as a practice session and do this 3 hours. And I guarantee you it'll put money in your pocket.
Yeah. Well, number one, let me tell you how crazy I am. I was thinking of the Rocky match when it was supposed to be an exhibition. and number two, when you're like doing those fake phone calls. But number two, I would say this for mid-career as well, because I do interviews for a living. And yet I'll go and be interviewed on a panel and they're like, so what's your name? And I'm like, so don't underestimate. We talked about this on a previous episode as far as that interview rust that comes as well. If you don't sit and do, no matter how experienced you are, most people aren't facing a 3-5 or 1-on-1 phone call interview on a day to day. So you get this hubris, like, oh, I've been, you know, I've got 10, 15 years of experience. I'll just go to the interview. And then you get there. And the main question, I told Rich about this. One of the questions was, why do you want this job? And I was stumped, which is like the most basic question. It's been around for five or 10 years.
No, I've been there. I feel you. I've been there too. One time. Okay. This just tells you how crazy and just so, you know, young I was. One of the interviews that I went on, this is when I had no idea what I wanted to do in my life. I was going around trying to be a paralegal. You could clearly tell I was very confused. So I went in, and it was like being a paralegal for this litigator and who went to court very often. And he asked me what my biggest weakness was. And I told him my biggest weakness was that sometimes I couldn't be on time. And like, if you're literally, if you are going for any job, like these are certain questions that you need to practice. You know, it's good to be honest, but you, I mean, that was just a stupid response. And I think that a lot of times when you don't practice, you forget about the things that you've done. I think it's really, especially when you're on a phone interview, to have all of your concrete examples that you've done in front of you. And I'm always impressed when it's like just numbers driven, you know, like I increased revenue by 50%. I brought in this many sponsorships, you know, we drove up streams, like video streams by this many percent. And you're just like, wow, it's not even like this person's great to, you know, has this much experience, but they're backing it up with numbers. And those numbers, you have to prepare those numbers. You don't just get those numbers out of thin air, you know?
That's a great point.
Yeah, I really like that. And Rich has brought that up before. It's an open book test. So on those phone interviews, cheat. Like people are like, oh no, yeah. that's unethical. I don't want to have something go. I'm like, cheat. Cheat, have six tabs open. I don't care what it is. Like, I mean, reference actual materials that you perform. But I think some people are like, well, no, that's unfair. I'm cheat, 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 cheat. Life hack, whatever you want to call it, cheat on those phone interviews.
Yeah.
Using real valid information, let me be clear.
And the last thing I would say is it's super important to have those numbers. And a lot of people struggle with that with their resumes, their LinkedIn profiles, whatever else. But in addition to the numbers, you also need to be ready to speak about the how. So it's like, here's what I accomplished. More than likely, if it's a good interviewer or even an average interviewer, they're going to say, tell me how you did that. So the numbers are super important, but make sure within your notes when you're cheating for the open book test that you also have a few talking points that spoke to how you did it, especially if it involved you taking the initiative or you had to collaborate across teams, significant project management. That's the perfect time to break all those things out. And that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
That's great advice. And also, I think that one other thing that we go through when you are a staff at Yahoo or at these big companies, you have these quarterly evaluations or these year-end evaluations. And if you want to get a peer to evaluate you, you have to send your self-evaluation to the other, to your peer to read what you wrote about your accomplishments for the year. And so a lot of people have sent me their peer evaluations and their self-evaluations. So I read the reports that people have written about themselves, and you should see the difference between the men and the women. I mean, the men are all about the hard numbers, how much revenue they brought in, like every, you know, how many productions that they oversaw, like everything is number, 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 and how much they delivered. And women do that as well, but it's a lot more general, you know? And so I think that it goes to show you, you need to, first of all, during these self-evaluations, you cannot take it lightly. If you're a journalist, I always say, like, your self-evaluation is the best story you've written all year. You know, it's, you have to like literally pour your energy into showing what you did for the company so that, because that's literally money in your pocket. And if you just take like, oh my God, I have so much work to do, and you put your self-evaluation last, you do it at like, you know, midnight, and then you just slap it together and you submit it. I mean, that is a huge mistake. So on the job, you know, take these things seriously. You know, going for the job, take these things seriously.
And I'm going to go ahead, and we got two questions for wrap up. I think we're going to roll in an hour or two if we're not careful here. we were scared to fill 30 minutes. Take your time. What is the most shocking information or greatest revelation, if you will, you've learned when it comes to salaries or career during your time at Yahoo Finance? But given their breadth of experience, it might be in any career. What is the most shocking information you've learned that people are or are not doing?
I think the most shocking thing is that people don't negotiate their salary and that people don't prepare and practice for the conversation. And it's the norm to not prepare for the salary discussion versus to prepare for it. And yeah, men or women, they don't seem to do it as much as I would think that they would. And people close in my life, when I say like, hey, we should just practice, if you're going to have this conversation, we should practice, they're very reluctant to practice with me. It feels like I'm pulling teeth for them. I don't understand why I have to be like, you need to make more money and we need to practice. Like, they should be asking me and saying, hey, can I practice with you? Versus the other way around. I'm like, hey, can I practice with you? Because I, you know, but once they do practice and once they do have the conversation, that, let's say 1 to 2 to 3 hours of practice has always landed in at least 5 to 10,000 more in their, you know, base salary discussion, or at least something more. I would say whether it was more vacation days or tuition reimbursement or, you know, maybe moving costs or something that has to do with, you know, starting at that new position, because there's a lot of like non-salary benefits that you can ask for that people also forget to do because they're just so focused on that base salary. But that's also money, you know? So I think that's been a big shocker for me.
I like it. I like it. So thank you for joining us. And where can the people find you around the web and the social medias?
Sure. They can find me at Yahoo Finance. I cover personal finance. If you hit the personal finance tab, all of my stories are there. You can also follow me at Jeannie531 on Twitter or Jeannie on Money on Instagram.
And that's Jeannie. For those who are curious, because somebody's going to probably put Geannie and be confused.
Thank you for clarifying that. Yes, yeah. Jeannie, like on money on Instagram, and Jeannie531, Jeannie531.
And we'll get all that information in the show notes. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure, guys.
As promised, a lot of great information. I think y'all now have the tools to prepare for a career negotiation, any challenges you may face, and then recognizing again, as we're going to hit, that mentorship and networking, sometimes it is whom you know more than what you know. And a lot of money can be saved, as we found with some of these certification programs, which continue to expand, focusing on the good ones and can help you move your career forward.
And you got to negotiate. And it's surprising to me, too, as a recruiter, the number of people who don't even really try to negotiate much. Or I ask them, so like, what are you looking for? How much are you thinking? Like, what's your baseline to accept? Blah, 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 blah. And they have no real answer for it. So I do think it's important to take that step of even preparing from the initial call. As soon as you know you're going to talk to a recruiter, to set aside time to prepare for how you're going to have that salary conversation. Even if you are in a state where they're not going to ask about your current or your past salary history, being able to talk about what it is you want going forward. And it's okay to say subject to change as I learn more about the role, you know?
I agree. Definitely some good information there. And speaking of good information and more helpful tips, don't forget to join our email list by visiting paychecksandbalances.com/email, where you receive our weekly newsletter covering actionable work and money tips and much more.
And if you've enjoyed today's episode or found it useful, be sure to share, you know, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, email, and also hit us with those 5 stars in Apple Podcasts. So we have another review for today, which, you know what? I'll read this one, good brother.
Appreciate it, sir.
So the subject in this one, great podcast with great perspectives and information. 5 stars from Board in AL, which might be Alabama, I'm going with. I first started listening to this podcast at the beginning of 2017 and enjoyed it. But knowing that I had missed all of the previous episodes, I felt compelled to catch up. I'm so glad I did. From a fellow senior millennial, this podcast has been a great resource. It has re-energized me to get back on the wagon that is on the road to financial freedom and fulfilling my career ambitions. It's also great hearing this sort of information from the perspectives and voices of young people of color. Y'all are awesome. I live in Texas. Okay, so it's not Alabama.
Shout out.
Keep doing what you're doing. So Board in AI, or is that an L? Appreciate that 5-star review. That's what's up. And if you're like, how do I leave a review? You can go to paychecksandbalances.com/review. All the steps will be right there.
Yes, sir. Thank you for that review. Thanks to everyone for listening. And Rich, you want to hit him with the official closeout?
Until next time, be safe. We out. Peace.